prepare yourself for the terror. The prison of madness, where few enter and none return.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Unsung Horrors, the podcast where we discuss underseen horror films, specifically those with fewer than 1,000 views on Letterboxd. I'm Lance.
And I'm Erica.
And there will be three of us today for this episode. It is Shaugus.
Yes.
Yes. Here at Unsung Horrors, where we cover Shaw Brothers horror films during the month of August.
Or Shaw Brothers adjacent, like last week.
That's true. That wasn't a Shaw Brothers, but it worked. And it wouldn't be Shaugus without having this guest here, right?
Yes.
So he joined us during our first ever Shaw Guest episode with Black Magic 2, which he provided the audio commentary for on the 88 films release. And then he also joined us last year with Portrait of Crystal. So I wanted to keep this tradition alive.
Yeah.
I had to. So I reached out to see if he was willing to join us. He graciously accepted. So
even after Portrait and Crystal.
Seriously.
Guest ever.
let's welcome Ian Jane. Ian, welcome.
Ian.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate it. I'm always happy to come on. I think you guys know that. But yeah, it is a pretty cool tradition at this point to do it every August.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Thanks for joining us. Yeah, so for those who may not have listened to the previous Shaw Guest episodes, or even the Spider episode that you were a guest on.
That's right, yep.
Yeah, first off, everybody, go check them out if you haven't listened to them. But Ian runs the site rockshockpop.com, or RSP, which is a review platform and a forums where he writes about cult films primarily, but also comics, music, physical media releases, all the good stuff you need to know more about. Yeah, it's just a fun place for people to chat about things that entertain them. It's a good time. It's a good site that you run, Ian. But
thank you.
Since we last chatted, you started a podcast.
I did. It's not movie related at all. It's the Queen's Comic Podcast. I do it with my friend Billy. Billy runs a monthly comic book show in New York City called the Queen's Comic Party. That's usually in Queens, although sometimes it's in Brooklyn. And so we kind of spun it off from that monthly show. And every 2 weeks or so, we sit in Billy's room full of comics and banter. It's literally banter. It's never scripted. Sometimes we have a rough idea of what we want to talk about. Try to cover the type of stuff that the other guys don't. So a lot of focus on undergrounds and independent stuff, but we'll cover Marvel and DC too, because we have to.
Right.
So yeah, you can check that out at queenscomicparty.com or on Spotify. Just search for Queen's Comic Party, or on iTunes, or basically anywhere you get podcasts.
Yeah, and each episode's under an hour too, which I love.
Typically, yeah. I think we went over an hour once, but that was probably by mistake.
So you guys are covering like the more underground stuff. So you're kind of like the unsung horrors of podcasts for comics.
Oh,
kind of. Yeah, I like that comparison.
Yeah, I've lost my way out of comics the last few years, and I think listening to this might, you know, I miss it. So I think it would help me get that desire back.
I got out for a decade and got back into it when COVID hit, because I didn't have a whole lot to do. So yeah. I just got caught up on a lot of it. And then, yeah, the bug bit, and I've been going full tilt since then. So
nice.
But it's good to take a break every once in a while.
Yeah. I feel like my break's been long enough. So I'm going to get on the Queen's Comic Podcast.
Do it.
Okay. So let's get to the movie.
Yeah.
How about it? This episode, we're talking about the Shaw Brothers Hong Kong horror Ghost Eyes, or Gui Yan, from 1974. It currently has 234 views on Letterboxd, and it's available to watch on YouTube with English subtitles. So we'll be obviously spoiling it as we talk about it, but here's a quick synopsis of Ghost Eyes. Balin is a manicurist at a beauty salon, and a mysterious man named Mr. Shi comes in. He's very aware of the placement of the mirrors in the shop, so he sits himself into a chair where there are no double mirrors. Balin gives him a quick manicure and immediately tells him she lives alone in a shitty apartment. When she leaves work, she's almost hit by a car and her glasses fall and break. Mr. Shi shows up and tells her, like everybody else in the movie, that she looks way better without glasses. And he offers up his services as an optometrist to get her set up with some contacts. She gets the contacts the next day and starts seeing dead people, including people that have died in mudslides and fires. Mr. Shi also starts coming over to her place at night, and his eyes glow, which seemed to put Balin in a hypnotized trance, and he has sex with her. She wakes up having no real memory of what happened, sometimes waking up in random places like abandoned houses and burned down buildings. She finds out that one of these buildings was an old optical shop that burned down 3 years ago, and the optician, Mr. Shi, died there. So Balin starts losing her mind. Her boyfriend, Anpin, begins helping her, trying to figure out what the hell's going on. The contacts at this point seem to have disintegrated into her eyes, becoming a part of her. So she continues to be hypnotized by Mr. Shi, who reveals that he's immortal and wants her to bring women to him so he can drain them of blood, which she does, taking a few co-workers to Mr. Shi. Anpin takes her to a Taoist monk who explains that Mr. Shi is actually possessed by a vampire demon. Should I keep going or should we wait for the ending?
I mean, yeah, like we've established the
issue a lot going
at this
on.
Point. There's a lot going on. And then also there's a lot of time where there's not really anything going on. But
that's true.
We'll talk about that too.
Yeah.
I think you're good for there from there though.
Okay, cool. So yeah, we'll get to the end and how it all wraps up. I'm sure when we start discussing the movie, but I'm going to list some of the cast and crew. But we've covered most of these folks in the past Shoggoth episodes. It'll just be me repeating kind of film credits and history of crew members and actors, most of whom are signed to the contract with Shaw Brothers Studios. So there's a lot of the same cast and crew in these films that we've already covered.
This is our way of getting everyone to listen to other Shoggoth episodes.
Exactly.
It's like, you want this info? You got to listen to the other episodes to get it, folks.
Yeah, I'm not going to spend much time here. Ian, Erica, feel free to just jump in if you have something else to say, or I forget to mention someone. But yeah, so Ghost Eyes is directed by Quay Chi Hung. He's responsible for some of the greatest supernatural horror films that came out of the Shaw Brothers filmography. Of course, we have The Boxer's Omen, Bewitched, which we covered last year, Hex and its two sequels, The Killer Snakes, The Bamboo House of Dolls, and one of my all-time favorites, Corpse Mania from 1981, which was my first Shoggoth pick.
Yeah. I did finally watch The Killer Snakes.
Yeah. How is that? That's one I have not seen.
I am not a better person for watching it. I'm just going to say that it's a lot of
dead snakes.
It's good. There's a lot of dead snakes in it.
That's my problem with it too. I like the movie a lot, but the older I get, the less I can deal with animal violence.
Yeah. And it's not even just like, okay, there's an opening where they're cutting out the certain part of a snake, like a, I don't know, the liver or something like that for potency, like to put it in a drink or something like that. Right. I'm like, ugh, okay, that's awful. But then the fucking end is just like, I mean, there's like snakes flying, swords flying. We're just cutting snakes in half. Then they're setting snakes on fire. And I'm like, come on.
It's amazing in like a psychotronic way, but I have trouble looking past that. Like, I won't say I didn't enjoy the movie. I also won't say I'm a better person for having seen it, like you said.
Yeah.
Like, I appreciate the insanity of it all, but it really does like, they just didn't give a shit about snakes. They're just like, yeah, we're going to kill as many snakes as we can for the purpose of making a movie. And
yeah,
it's
there's reason to have objections to that.
Yeah. It should have been called Killing Snakes.
Yeah.
Instead of the other snakes.
Yeah. I mean, they do the snakes are killers, but then it turned like the tables quickly get turned on them. And then it turns back, which, you know, I can't even be happy for the snake's vengeance. All I'm going to say is that Shishi from Fangs of the Cobra remains the best pet snake ever.
100%. Yeah. I'll probably kick the killer snakes on the back burner for a while. That's the one main Quay Chi Hung I haven't watched.
Yeah.
I guess one could say that Chi Hung's stronger film started in the 80s. That's when he directed all the Hex films, Corpse Mania, The Boxer's Omen, Bewitched, Curse of Evil, all between 1980 and 83, which is, you know, extraordinary to think about. But it's something we see from a lot of these Shaw Brothers directors during that time. They're just pumping out a ton of movies, really put to work. So, I mean, he was an amazing director who just stopped making movies less than a year after The Boxer's Omen was released, which is like, what a way to leave the industry, right?
Yeah. Go on a high note.
Yeah. With one of the best, if not the best supernatural horrors of like all time, in my opinion. Yeah, he decided to immigrate to the U.S. and open a pizza joint, which I talked about, Corpse Mania. More details there. So Ghost Eyes, it's based on a story by Chin Yu Wen. The screenwriter of Ghost Eyes, though, we talked a little about in our last episode and pretty much every other previous episode of Shawgust, Ni Kuang. He's probably responsible for writing your favorite Shaw Brothers movie.
Yeah.
I mean, list your top five. He's definitely involved in probably three of them. Ian, you got anything on Ni Kuang that you want
to
throw
out? Well, first of all, going back to the director, according to the Hong Kong Movie Database, I don't know if this is true or not, but according to that website, he has a son named Beaver.
Beaver?
Yeah.
Okay.
Has a son named Beaver.
Hell yeah. This man knows how to name a child.
Yeah, so there's that. But as far as Ni Kuang goes, I mean, how much detail do you want to go into? His life is pretty insane. I don't know, did you guys go into his whole biography or anything? I got notes, but they're long notes.
Oh, do you have stuff like when he was like, I know he was imprisoned for a long time. Yeah, I don't think we talked anything about that.
No, I only talked briefly about like his writing career and like the fantasy novels and stuff like that he wrote. So it was mainly his writing career. I didn't get into like his personal life because normally we don't get too far into that. But Ian, if you got it, flaunt it.
I got it because I've done a few other Shaw Brothers commentaries that are coming out later this year. So I wound up doing a deep dive on Ni Kuang for one of them. Nice. And I won't go over all of it, but yeah. So at 16, he joined the People's Liberation Army, and he did security work there, but he was found guilty of destruction of public property and he was sent to prison for a decade. They accused him of being a counter-revolutionary. His side of the story is that what happened was that he and a few other soldiers actually took planks off a wooden bridge and burned them to keep themselves warm during the winter. So, you know, in his eyes, it was justified, but in the eyes of the Communist Party, it was definitely not. And he busted out of jail, basically.
Oh, wow.
And was then, his family hired human traffickers to smuggle him out of China into Hong Kong in the 50s, which is pretty insane.
Oh, yeah.
And then once he got to Hong Kong, he didn't return to the mainland after that, from what I understand. So he had a lot of outspoken anti-communist views. There's interviews with him online. There's articles about him on the New York Times that go into a lot of detail about it. And his anti-communist sentiment comes through in a lot of his work. Maybe not Ghost Eyes specifically, but
yeah.
And because of this, a lot of the books he wrote, because he wrote more books than he did films, believe it or not, they wound up being banned in China because of his political views. So yeah. He's got an interesting backstory. And if you do a deeper dive into some of the themes that a lot of the films that he worked on deal with, if you peel back the layers a little bit, it's there. A lot of themes dealing with like personal freedom and individuality rather than just towing the Communist Party line.
So can we expect like one of these releases you mentioned to be one of those kind of underlying messages?
I can mention two of the commentaries of the five that I've done so far.
Okay.
Because two of them have been announced. So on the Shell Factory Shaw Brothers Collection Volume 2, or I'm sorry, Shaw Brothers Classics Volume 2, I did the track for Lady of Steel, and then I did the track for Delightful Forest.
Nice.
Awesome.
The other three I can't mention yet.
Okay.
Shell Factory, I'm sure, will make notes of the extras on the upcoming releases when they feel like it. So.
Very cool.
Fingers crossed for Ghost Eyes.
Ghost Eyes is unfortunately not one of them. I would have jumped on the chance to do Ghost Eyes.
Sweet. Well, this is your commentary. Like, this is that we're happy you're here.
Yeah. Close enough. Yeah, thank you.
If the opportunity comes up, you can like say, I did a whole podcast about it, so I've got all my notes all ready to go. And so
there you go.
Yeah, so you're you're all set for it. So
no research required.
Yeah.
Okay, so one reason that Ghost Eyes really stands out for me is the original score. So the composer in the film credits is listed as Young Yu Chin, who on Letterboxd only has a handful of credits listed. Other Shaw Brothers films, including Five Fingers of Death, The Avenging Eagle, and The Black Tavern. On IMDb, though, he's listed as composing the music for The 36th Chamber of Shaolin, The Oily Maniac, Chinatown Kid, over 200 film credits. But on Letterboxd, these film credits go to Frankie Chan Fan K as the composer, who also did the music for The Five Venoms, Crippled Vengers, Masters of the Flying Guillotine, just a ton of Shaw Brothers film. And from what I can find during a little research online is this is one and the same person. Ghost Eyes composer Yu Chin is Frankie Chan, but his earlier films had Young Yu listed. And you actually see this, I've seen this quite a bit in like these movie databases where the names are different from these, Hong Kong-based artists.
The Hong Kong movie database tends to be a little bit more accurate when it comes to these movies most of the time. I don't want to say all the time, but
Yeah.
I also think it's more common than not for a lot of the Hong Kong filmmakers and composers and actors to have more than one name that they're credited under.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. So, I mean, I love this music, the musical cues and the score in this movie. I think it's the star of the movie for me.
It is too. I was convinced that this was lifted from something Italian.
Me too.
Oh yeah. The whole thing has Italian vibes.
Yeah. But I was, mm-hmm. And usually like if I'm convinced, I'm like, I've heard this score somewhere before. I've got a few people on Letterboxd who, like, if they've seen the movie, usually in their review, they'll name the right. score. And usually John can hear it too. Cause he's got his, Rain Man brain with that. So, and I went through the reviews and nobody had mentioned another like Italian movie or Italian composer. And I was like, holy shit, is this actually an original score that sounds like this for a Hong Kong movie? And it's not lifted from.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
I think it is. Yeah, I think it is. I actually pulled out my phone and pulled Shazam up a couple of times to see if it could find anything, because a lot of times with the Italian soundtrack stuff, especially the bigger stuff like the Morricone or the Risardolani, it'll find it right away.
Yeah.
And it wasn't finding anything. So, but I agree, like, it sounded very familiar and it sounded like something out of an old Italian Gothic horror film, but
right.
If it is lifted, I can't figure out from where.
Yeah.
I mean, it sounds like nothing that Shaw Brothers has done in any other right. genre. I mean, that's why I love it so much, because same as you, I thought a lot of their stuff is lifted, recycled and
recycled.
but in this case, I couldn't track anything down, and it's amazing because, yeah, like you said too, Ian, it's like inspiration for like Simonetti or Keith Emerson or like later Argento. It's crazy. Did you guys want to? Before I jump in the cast, anybody else in the crew you wanted to chat about? I mean, I know the producers or Run Me Shaw, like everybody's kind of we've hit on in the past.
I'll keep Mona Fong's name out of my mouth this episode.
Okay. okay. So the cast, I'm going to do my best. Every year I cringe. Every year I look forward to Shaw-gas, but at the same time I worry and cringe about me mispronouncing these names.
No one's given us a bad review for it yet. Okay.
Here we go. No disrespect. I'm a dumb American. It's well known. But here we go. Okay. Su Chia Chen plays Bao Lin, the lead character in Ghost Eyes. This is her first acting role. She went on to act in a lot of, other great Shaw Brothers films, including 36 Chamber, Dirty Ho, Hex. She played Du Sha in Portrait in Crystal,
yep.
Prince Tiandi's wife, mm-hmm. if you don't remember. But Ghost Eyes being her first acting role is really impressive to me, because I think it's a pretty physical role. You kind of see her as she like turns into this exhausted, beaten down character who still wants to fight it out to the very end. Strong performance, in my opinion. I dug her.
I agree.
Wei Su plays the creepy Mr. Shi Cheng Che, the vampire optometrist Batty. I'm pulling Batty from the Nine Demons.
It works.
I've only watched one other film that he's been in, and it's amazing. It's a Shaw Brothers action fantasy called The Battle Wizard. Have y'all seen it? I know you have. Yeah, it's a wild one. I mean, similar pacing.
Battle Wizards is mandatory viewing.
Yeah, absolutely. Under 80 minutes.
Yep. Yeah.
Is that the Kiss makeup one?
No.
What am I thinking of?
You're thinking of
Bat Without Wings. I know it started.
No, this one is just straight up kind of like fantasy, like
right.
flying daggers and laser swords.
Hang on,
and
I'm looking at it up. Like I gotta make. Okay, yeah, I have seen this. Oh, I gave it 4 stars.
Yeah.
Hang on, what did I review? What did I write?
Got a lot of lasers in it.
A lot of lasers.
Oh, okay.
The poster's amazing too. From what I remember, or the one on Letterboxd. But yeah, similar crazy pacing to Portrait and Crystal, where you're like, whoa, slow down. This is amazing, but I'm dying here.
It's a lot.
Wei Su also has like 24 or so other acting credits, mainly lesser known Shaw Brothers films from the 70s, like The Sexy Killer, A Slice of Death. And he is in a few anthologies, the Fearful Interlude, which was directed by Kwei Chi Hung, mm-hmm. and The Criminals.
Oh, I've seen that.
Yeah.
It's got a dead kid.
Oh, sorry. It does. Yeah, spoiler. It does.
Next, we have Lam Wai Tiu, who plays An Pin, Balin's nerdy bookworm boyfriend, kind of. His name might have popped up a few times in previous Shaw-gas episodes. I don't remember, but he has small roles in Bewitched, Corpse Mania, and Black Magic 2. Mm. know, all
he's
of
in the first one as well, I think.
Yeah, he's in part one. He's also in The Mighty Peking Man. He has a lot of good Shaw Brothers credits. Ping Ha plays Yuan Ma, who is a coworker, maybe a manager at the beauty salon. I couldn't really figure out her role. But she has hundreds of film and television credits, having started acting in the 1950s. Most of her film credits are either a mother or a wife role to an important character. Credits include Human Lanterns, Sammo Hung's My Lucky Stars, Kwai Chi Hung's Killer Constable. Then we have Bloody Parrot, which could potentially be a Shaw-Gus pick in the future if we keep going.
I'd be down with that.
She's also in Battle Wizards. Yeah. Wan Ching Ho plays the Taoist monk. I kind of want to throw him out there because his credits are insane. He's also in a ton of Shaw Brothers movies. Eight Diagram Pole Fighter, Five Fingers of Death, all three 36 Chamber movies, Dirty Ho, Human Lantern, Seating of a Ghost, which is another great one, Corpse Mania, another one with just hundreds and hundreds of credits.
Yeah.
Five Deadly Venoms.
Five Deadly Venoms, yes.
Yeah. 372 credits.
Good Lord.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what you see with these actors. Like, it's amazing.
Every August, I just, my mind is blown with the sheer amount of films that, like, in such a short period of time. Because I think of someone who, like, oh, maybe they started acting as, like, a child, like Kurt Russell, and then, like, all the way into, you know, like, maybe up until their 80s. Like, I would expect, you know, someone like that. They just, it's insane to me. Every time I see it, I'm just like blown away by it.
Yeah. His career lasted 4 decades. So 372 movies in 40 years.
That's roughly almost 100. I'm like, that's just every decade.
It's like looking at Kwai Chi Hung too. Like, I mean, he's directing what, 10 films and like three. I mean, and some of these directors are pumping out even more than that. It's crazy.
Yeah. It's just, to me, it's just such a testament of like such massively entertaining films, especially when we're talking about, you know, Boxer's Omen and a bunch of the other ones that we have before that have stood the test of time, that have a very limited budget, or, you know, from Shaw Brothers, and what they're able to do with that and make something so wildly inventive versus something that, you know, Blumhouse gives $5 million to somebody about, you know, a talking hand and is like, my mom's dead. And, you know, it's like, come on, you know?
I think you have to give a lot of credit to that, to the writers, because Shaw Brothers had, I mean, with the whole movie town, city within the city deal that they had set up with all of the actors living on site and most of the cast and crew and directors living on site. They had everything set up to basically work as an assembly line and a lot of times had them working on multiple projects at the same time. So it wasn't cookie cutter because, like you said, there's so much originality and so much of their stuff and so much wackiness and insanity out there for us all to dig our teeth into. But it was one after the other, after the other, after the other. It was very much a commercial endeavor meant to be pumped out fast, on time, and on budget. So you got to give the script writers and the directors, of course, and the set designers a lot more credit than just the producers who are really just kind of bankrolling the next big thing.
Yeah.
And then you have like one single editor that's almost like knocking every single one of these out. Like
analyzing it.
Chang Sing Lung, I think I'm pronouncing his name right. But he's like, his credits are 600 movies or something. Mm-hmm. Like, it's insane.
Yeah. It's just this well-oiled machine, and not even just like their film production, their film town. I feel it's probably in The Killer Snakes, but because he asks this girl on a date and he's like, hey, do you want to go to a movie tonight? And they go to a Shaw Brothers theater. And I think I've probably seen it in a Shaw Brothers film before where people go to the movies and it's like Shaw Brothers logo on the movie theater. Like that.
Yeah. They owned a bunch of them.
Yeah. It's like they're so it's like, okay, we make our own movies and we put it in our theaters and everyone fucking goes to them. And it's just, you set it on repeat year after year. And it's just, like I said, every August when we talk about it, it's just how much they were able to put out and the well-oiled machine that they have. You know, I look at other companies who seemingly have a monopoly, like looking at you, Disney, on shit that I would normally complain about. And you could draw a line to that, but Disney's not like, doesn't have like exploding bats and like, you know, fun stuff.
I mean, right. Yeah. At this point, it's throwing a couple of actors in a green screen room. And
right.
So the production design, again, goes back, like the Shaw, I mean, it's something that'll never happen again, obviously. And it's so, it's such an awesome piece of history to, yeah, to think about. But yeah, every August too, I love it. Cause if you watch only like 5 Shaw Brothers movies, your most watched actors are probably going to be pulled from those 5 movies. Like they're going to pop up on your Letterbox stats.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there are a few other characters that pop up at the end of the movie, like Ewan Maw's great auntie and her granddaughter. But that's all the cast and crew I have. Do you guys have anybody I missed or anybody else you want to talk about?
I got a bit.
Okay.
So talking about prolific performers, the actress who played Great Auntie is Masu Ying. Mm-hmm. She worked from 47 till 76, 554 credits.
Wow. Oh my God. Yeah.
They had her like chained in the studio. I
mean, so a lot of them are bit parts, right?
And yeah. Right, right.
It's the same with all these guys. A lot of, you know, especially when they're first starting out, they're credited as an extra or they're credited as being, you know, they're in one scene. So they probably showed up on set for a day and maybe in that same day appeared in 3 movies, but even still.
Yeah, that's insane to think about.
Yeah, that's a lot. And then Yung Chok Lam, who played Ah Wei, the husband of the woman whose name I'm forgetting.
Oh, I haven't written down.
The workmate. The salon, who she goes to her house at the end.
Yeah.
So he was pretty prolific too. He did 98 movies, only 98 movies from 68 till 2011 when he retired. started doing a lot of extra work in bigger films. He appears in Chang Che's Vengeance, and he's in Lady of Steel. I know that because, like I said, I just did the commentary on it. Yeah. He also pops up in Police Story 2, and he's in Battle Wizard because we need to mention Battle Wizard as much as we can tonight. And then sadly, I could not figure out who played Fatty.
Oh, the kid.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Who is literally named Fatty.
Yeah, there's a lot of that in
Shaw Brothers. It wasn't Kent Chang because he's an adult.
Right. No, we had a Fatty in the last one we did too.
Yeah.
Tradition
continues, but we don't know who it is. So. Uh-huh.
Cool. That's all I got for cast and crew. That's all I think we got.
We'll get into our thoughts about the film right after this promo from our network.
You're listening to the Prescribed Films Podcast Network, home to hundreds of hours of free podcast entertainment. The shows on this network all have a common goal, providing you with the best discussions about movies and other forms of entertainment media. The PFPN hopes to fill your earholes with audio joy. Visit our website with links to all the other amazing shows at www.thepfpn.com. Thanks for listening.
Okay, so something I really love about Ghost Eyes is, to me, And most of Kwei Chi Hung's Shaw Brothers horror films, is it's kind of straight up horror. There's not a lot of what you might expect from Shaw Brothers movies. You might expect the martial arts, a little kung fu fighting, some humorous moments. You know, the touches of the action that make Shaw Brothers films so recognizable and appealing. But with like Ghost Eyes and Kwei Chi Hung horror movies, I love it when they gravitate more so to the horror genre over anything else. Because, you know, with Bewitched, Corpse Mania, Seating of a Ghost, Black Magic has some humorous moments too.
But it's not like overtly like trying to add in the comedy or like the comic relief or anything like that. It just has like moments that are chuckle worthy.
Right. So I almost feel like when you watch a movie like Ghost Eyes or some of the Shaw Brothers horror, you kind of have to reset your Shaw Brothers expectations, just kind of take a step back. Enter in this Kwei Chi Hung jam with a new perspective. Mm-hmm. Don't compare them to other Shaw Brothers movies. I don't know. I mean, because I read a lot of Letterboxd reviews on Ghost Eyes, and there's a lot of comparing to other movies, which, you know, I do a lot. Sure. But I feel like, because it is very slow-paced, which I know you have notes on. We all do, I think. But you know, comparing them to, you know, people's understandable favorites, I don't know if it's fair for this specific movie because it is, we've already talked about the music, even some of the, like the gel lighting, because this is 1974. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is early in the horror catalog for Shaw Brothers. There's so many inspirations that I feel like are pulled or lifted from a movie like this.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, what do you think when you think, Ian, when you watch Ghost Eyes, do you think it's more, are you hoping for action or are you really you want the horror. Like you're really pleased with how the horror is being presented in these Quay Chi Hung type movies.
So no bad pun intended, but I went into this completely blind.
with Ghost Eyes.
I didn't even write that down. I just threw that one out there. I had not seen it before. So I went in expecting it to be way more over the top because most of the Shaw Brothers stuff is, but there's no nudity in it. There's no real gore. There's some makeup effects, you know, but there's no splatter. There's no icky bugs. There's no animal violence. It, like I said earlier, it feels in a lot of ways very much like an Italian Gothic horror film to me, more than what most people associate with the more exploitative, almost trashy, insane Shaw Brothers horrors that get all the eyeballs. I guess maybe I expected a little bit of that and maybe a bit more action. You guys said you had problems with the pacing. I didn't really have problems with the pacing personally. It was a little repetitive, I felt, and maybe could have trimmed it about 5 minutes maybe, but I was okay with it. It held my attention throughout. I didn't have a trouble with the pacing at all. I think I was really drawn in by the cinematography, which I thought was really impressive.
Yeah, very much so.
You mentioned the lighting gels, and there's a lot of great use of primary color throughout the movie. I hate to say Bava-esque because it's such a cliche to say it, but it does.
Yeah, I mean, it is what it is.
Yeah, it is what it is, exactly. It does kind of feel like it could have been a Bava movie,
right?
Or something like maybe an old Antonio Margheriti film or something like that. Yeah. But I was pulled in. I was pulled in. There's
it's
a lot of nonsense in the plot, but sure. It held my attention without any trouble.
I mean, I also liked how deliberately paced it is because it's setting up, and again, it's a valid argument that it's taken way too long. But you're watching Powland losing her mind and her senses. And I think it really sets up her delirium and her exhaustion. Like we, the viewer, are almost exhausted at this point too. And we're waiting for the finale to come because we're kind of, for me personally, I was kind of like struggling with her. Like I could totally feel, again, like I felt like it is a physical role because, you know, the makeup that they apply as the movie goes on, like you can tell she's weary and she should be because we just watched an hour of her, you know, waking up in abandoned houses over and over again, being sexually assaulted. Like it takes a long time for people to start showing concern. I mean, one thing I could take a step back and be like, okay, it took a long time for people to show concern. It took about 45 minutes for Powland to finally ask for help. And there's, you know, instead she's kind of doing her own detective work, which actually made me think also of other Italian films.
Yep.
Yeah.
So I actually liked it. I mean, I do think I think it could work like in a lot of these anthologies, like the Fearful Interlude or the Haunted Tales as a 40 minute short or a segment. I like how it's kind of stretched out.
The pacing is one thing. I think it's just the fact that we're watching her kind of do the same thing over and over again, and it kind of suffers from the back half of it is like, okay, we know what the solution is here, and we're waiting for her to figure it out, and for her to finally figure out the smoke thing is just like.
Yeah.
I'm not struggling along with her because I'm like, I know the solution. Come on, figure it out. Like, let's go. And like, you know, Ian, you said 5 minutes, I'm going to go 10 or 15 minutes could have got knocked off of this. But like, I'm also with you, Ian. Like I was fully engaged the whole time with it. Like it's not losing me. I'm just also like, we didn't need that scene because this event already happened just kind of like in a different way. But
yeah, it's a little repetitive.
I'm still captivated by everything that I'm seeing on screen, you know, cinematography, the lighting, all of those things, those horror elements that you mentioned, Lance, that, you know, I think, you know, when we're talking about, you know, how much it reminds me of, or how much it reminds us of Italian films, when we see the ghost vampire, I know they're interchangeable in Hong Kong, but the quote unquote ghost vampire optometrist, when we see his true self through the double mirror, it reminds me of the zombies from Burial Ground.
Yeah. They're kind of bulky faced.
Yeah.
Like it's heavily applied makeup.
Yeah.
Just a mask. Yeah. But there's other shots though where he's just kind of got like some green face paint on where I thought he looked like Lou Ferrigno's the Hulk.
Yeah, that kind of reminded me of the Yamamoto's Bloodthirsty trilogy, like Lake of Dracula with like
greenish context. Yes, it's funny you mention that. Funny you mention that, because last night as I was watching it, I was like, who does this guy remind me of? Who does he remind me of? And I looked him up afterwards and I'm like, he doesn't really remind me of anybody. And it was the Japanese Dracula trilogy. That's exactly what it was. That was stuck in my brain for like the last 24 hours.
So pulled it thank out you for of both.
Pulling it out of there.
But yeah, like I hit on Kuei Chi Hung's Cameron work a little bit and his framing when we covered Corpse Mania and his ability to kind of present the viewer with the layout of the scenery before any action or dialogue happens. So again, I think that's why the taking your time, taking, you know, his time and setting up a scene, because there's, you know, when you go to an abandoned house, you're going to see pretty much every angle of every room before anything starts to happen, which I was totally sold on. I just fall in love with his establishing shots. And I wanted to pull and repeat something from Laird's Corpse Mania review on Letterboxd, where he's talking about Kuei Chi Hung. He says, "The more of his work I see, the more I'm convinced that he's the Hong Kong equivalent of Mario Bava. Someone very much in control of the look of his movies, someone able to hop genres with ease, and someone who builds movies with extremely graphic and exciting set pieces," which I think is prevalent in Ghost Eyes. You know, Corpse Mania, I think, blows it out of the water. But
yeah,
when I was watching it or rewatching it again, I kept thinking, like, I could watch like an hour of just his establishing shots, like just a montage of this stuff. Loved it.
I could watch an hour of that fake spider.
The fake spider. Yes, that was my fake spider. Great fake spider. There was also, is it the second or the third sex scene in the movie where, you know, they're lying horizontally and it's, you know, they're in the widescreen taking up most of the frame, but there's a lot of it is shot through the skull.
Yeah. Oh my God. I love that.
That reminded me of like a Nikatsu Roman porno film where they have to use weirdly placed objects to block genitalia and pubic hair to get around the sensors and stuff. Mm-hmm. I mean, Hong Kong didn't have that problem, so it wasn't done for that reason, I'm sure, but that's what I thought of because it's such a weird placement for it.
Yeah.
But it's a great composition.
Well, yeah, this is reminding me of the opening credits, which is one of my favorite openings to like a horror Shaw Brothers film, which is that neon green text over like the slow zoom out of the blue skull with the like hot pink background. It's 100% my aesthetic.
Yeah. Like, well, even like the other, I mean, and I don't know if it was like the copy that's on YouTube, but I'm going to say that it's no, I'm going to say like this was intentional, but the text of the credits being blurry and I'm like, it's setting you up for like her vision being distorted. And I was like, oh, that's a clever little touch there.
Yeah. That whole setup, the whole intro with the blurry text and what I was seeing, and then the music on top of it, the very Italian sounding, like just slow kind of tom beats, drum beats. I was like, okay, I'm going to take my time with this and I'm going to keep my eyes out for this whole movie.
Cause they carry on the blurry idea too later in the film, because after she gets the car accident happens and her glasses get knocked off, we see it through her POV.
Right.
That's true. Yeah. Blurry
for a while there too. And then of course, when she's getting fitted for the contacts and having her eyes tested and stuff, we see things blur in and out. I just got fitted for glasses a couple of months ago. So watching that on the movie was weirding me out in a big way. I'm also completely like phobic about having things touch my eyes. So anytime I see somebody in a movie or TV show put a contact lens in, I'm completely squeamish about it.
Yeah.
So y'all have never worn worn contact,
never.
Either of y'all.
I don't want anything touching my eyeballs. Not even for like Halloween costumes. No, not doing it.
Okay.
Same.
Yeah, no, I was curious. I was curious about this because I wore contacts like at the end of high school. It's when I got glasses and I preferred contacts because, you know, like Paolin, everybody said he looked better with contacts.
Yeah, you didn't want people like screaming at you like, nerd.
Yeah, now I'm like, I'm wearing glasses all the time.
Yeah.
But I have never had an experience with an optometrist or an eye doctor, even when I first first got contacts with. Nobody's ever put contacts in my eye.
Ooh, God.
Like this thing and Ghost Eyes. Like I was shuddering when that was happening. I was like, ooh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, that scene also, I mean, and I've worn contacts, I can wear them still, but having somebody put that in your eye for
touch
you.
Touch your eye. No, 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 no.
But yeah, to hit more on the Italian horror, I know we've already kind of, you know, talked about it quite a bit, but a few things that also stood out other than like the soundtrack, the gel lighting, also the pacing, but the constant thunderous rain made me think of like, you know, Suspiria and you know, Argento later movies, because this all predates most of Argento's like neon lighting stuff. This was before Deep Red, Suspiria, Inferno, all that good stuff. But yeah, definitely feels like Black Sabbath or something, or Blood and Black Lace lighting. And then just the supernatural and mysterious things that you're watching on screen. Like, you're unable to explain what's happening. You're just kind of living in this strange world and watching someone cope with what's happening to them. That the whole thing just, like, the first time I watched it, like, over a year ago, was like, this is the most Italian Shaw Brothers movie you will ever watch.
Even more so than Corpse Mania, you think?
Well, yeah, that, it has like giallo elements, Corpse Mania. But I would say visually, yeah, no, yeah. Okay. And pace-wise, sure. And the runtime. I mean, you're not going to get an 80 minute.
I know. Damn you, Italy.
There's another moment when the mudslide happens when she leaves the salon and is on her way home.
Yeah.
That reminded me of the ending of The Beyond.
Oh, shit. Yeah.
Totally. Yeah. Just the way they're all kind of trapped and in this muddy, hazy mess. Right. Like,
sort of coming towards her. The color scheme sort of matches up too.
Mm-hmm.
And there's, is she dead? Isn't she dead? Is she in hell? Isn't she in hell thing happening?
Yeah, obviously, for sure.
This predates The Beyond by quite a few years, but that's what stuck in my head when that scene happened.
Yeah, I kept thinking of the church too. I mean, all sorts of things were popping up with these images.
So
And it's weird that it's a Hong Kong horror film with some actual Christian iconography in it, which isn't common, because he tries. The cross doesn't work really very well to repel the vampire, but he at least gets a hold of one and uses it.
Yeah. I do like the mix there. Like, like you mentioned, like, it's like this mix of what we're used to with Hong Kong vampires, because we bring the Taoist priest in, and then like the Western vampire elements where it's like sucking blood and, you know, hypnotizing and all those sorts of those other elements. I want to go back to the landslide thing only because, like, that she sees all these ghosts. She sees other ghosts too. Mm-hmm. This is one of those like plot elements, and I'm not normally one to I don't want to like nitpick plot elements and, you know, a Hong Kong movie or an Italian movie, but why does she need to see ghosts if the whole purpose of the contacts was for the vampire to control her mind, suck her blood, get her to get other women? Like, what's...
Well, I'm going to start making shit up right
okay,
now.
Okay, that's
just,
fine.
Just, like, I'm going to try and figure things out live right now. So, yeah, I like the vampire take here. And it's some sort of, like, vampire demon that hops into dying people as a host. So I'm wondering if, like, these magic contacts that he puts in her eyes is maybe what vampires or these demons, maybe they see because they're seeking out dying people. And maybe, I don't know, maybe they're stuck in some weird... Yeah, I'm going too deep.
Yeah, you're not
yeah, explaining. Yeah, no, it's...
I'm just putting it out there that, like, that just sort of...
Because it's fucking cool, Erica.
Okay, fine.
It makes
for
cool scenes.
That's all you need. There it is. That's it. But, yeah.
And also, he's a vampire, and he does want other, specifically female victims. I don't remember him ever drinking anybody's blood or biting anybody on the neck. He's just getting laid a lot.
They don't show
it. They show the bodies.
They show the bodies, yes.
I love that scene.
That was a great reveal.
Oh, yeah.
Good, great practical effects there.
Right. So I don't know. I guess it leaves open to interpretation. Like, is he a Western vampire? Is he a Chinese vampire? Yeah, a combination of the two?
Life force.
Is he a sex vampire rather than a traditional vampire? Because he makes an allusion to her being under his control sexually at one point when he says to her, "You like my little favors," when she tries to get away from him, and suggesting that, you know, he is doing just that and controlling her sexually rather than supernaturally. But it doesn't really establish it very well. It's a lot is not established very well in this movie. A lot of gray areas.
Yeah, it does. And again, like you already noted, that there's no nudity in this, but there was no real censorship either during that time. But yeah, I was almost confused. Like, I thought maybe I was watching a cut copy when Palin was dropping off her friends, and then, you know, they enter the house, and then boom, the next cut is like she's back at work and the cops are looking for her. I'm like, we're missing a lot of, you know, what, you know, horror genre fans want most out of these type of movies. But when you take a step back, I'm like, this really works for me. So I know, Erica, in our Discord channel, you asked about, our villain here, the vampire possessed demon character, Mr. Shi, he whistles a lot. He whistles a tune quite a lot throughout the movie. And I love it. I mean, at first it reminded me of like Robert Mitchum singing Leaning on the Everlasting Arms in the Night of the Hunter. It's kind of like this creepy.
It has that vibe.
Yeah. Like these characters are terrorized by this tune. And you ask, you know, what's your favorite like villain or person whistling in a film? And we had some good answers.
We did get some good answers. And I did it selfishly because I wanted to give my top five ranked whistlers in films too on top of this. Fun fact also, I did discover there are these like toy vampire teeth from like the 70s called whistling Dracula teeth. You can Google this and find them. And because so like one of the plastic teeth is hollow, so you can actually be a whistling vampire if you want to, folks.
Ghost eyes merchandise.
I'm literally Googling this right now. I need these.
Yeah. I was like, I found them on eBay for like $20. And I was like, I might have to buy these for
20 bucks. Yeah. I guess they're no longer made.
No,
seems like money well spent though.
I think so. I mean, I might,
we should do a whole episode wearing them. See what
that would be fun. But yeah, so we did get some great answers from folks. And one of the ones that did get brought up was C. Welkin brought up Harry Powell in Night of the Hunter. And I couldn't remember him whistling that tune. I thought he just sang it.
I think he just sings.
Okay.
But
I was like,
it's very reminiscent of that.
Right. I'm due for a rewatch anyway, because I just got the 4K. So like I can definitely confirm. I'll rewatch. I don't care if he's singing or whistling, whatever Mitchum's saying, I'm listening.
There was one perfect answer in the Discord.
There was one perfect answer. Do you want to share that one?
It's Bronson in Once Upon a Time in the West.
No, that was that mentioned?
That was not mentioned, but that is on my list.
No, it's Alan Adele, the singing rooster from Robin Hood cartoon.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yep. Media Membrane did that. And as soon as he said that, I was like, oh, okay.
Yeah, everyone gave the thumbs up on 100%, that 100%,
yeah.
So, yeah.
I have one. Let's see if it's on your list.
Okay. Well, let me go through everyone else's picks, and then I'll do mine. So, Curdy mentioned Shadmock's Deadly Whistle in the first story from The Monster Club.
That's a good one.
Honestly, that one sounds more like a cicada than a whistle. Right. I've triggered with cicadas because those things leave their fucking corpses everywhere around here, and it's
they're huge. They're meaty.
Jim, he put Garth whistling the Enterprise theme in Wayne's World when they're on top of the car, which I thought was fun. Adam said Terry O'Quinn in The Stepfather, whistling Camptown Races. And then Omaha John and MPLS Matt picked another one that was on my list, and that's Hans Beckard and M. Mm-hmm. And so I'm not putting Ghost Eyes on the list because we're talking about the film. So here's my other five, including, so we have M, then Twisted Nerve / Kill Bill, which we've talked about before in one of our previous episodes.
That's a good pick.
Here, got any change, mate? And the best of British luck to you, too.
Henry Silva in Cry of a Prostitute.
Oh.
And of course, it's a list, so I'm going to cheat. So I have one that's not actually a film, but it's Omar in The Wire.
Check it out. Here it comes.
Something ain't right, yo.
Watch out, man. Look on that fool.
packing. Here he comes.
Yo. Yo, son, come on. Yo, Omar's coming, man. Oh, shit!
Okay.
Omar coming.
Okay, so mine is Emilio Estevez as Billy the Kid in Young Guns.
Of course it is.
That one scene, you know, where he likes, you know, the ladies like him. He likes to, it's rumored he likes to whistle sad ballads. He just starts whistling. I love that scene.
Yeah, sure. You are a testy little cuss.
Okay, we've covered the whistling aspect of this movie.
Yes, Lance Ian, have you pulled the trigger on buying the whistling Dracula teeth?
No, but I have found one for sale. I'm thinking about it. I just don't want to bust out my credit card while I'm doing
a podcast. Is it on eBay?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So
a bidding war, folks.
let's just throw out some of our favorite scenes and favorite parts of this movie, or any type of issues we might have of it. I just want to bring out one of my favorite turn of events, which there are a lot of. There's a lot of changes within the last like 30 minutes where you just don't know where this is going. My favorite is when the landlord runs in and Balin is there, I think with Ann Peen, and she just had like one of her episodes, and she's basically like, Jesus, girl, you look like shit. Your eyes look like dead fish. You smell like ass. You're possessed. We need to get you a Taoist monk ASAP.
Yeah.
That turn of events, I was like, okay, where are we going with this now? Yeah. What are some of your guys' favorite moments?
So tying into that, I liked that moment too. And I figured it was going to go turn into a Taoist priest versus monster battle like a lot of these movies do. Instead, the priest gets the shit kicked out of him.
Right. Mm-hmm.
I didn't see that coming. Also, the priest has a great line while he's preparing for
the
battle that he loses, where he says, when you are in the cinema, you can't be sure that the person behind you is human.
Yes, I have that note too. Probably causing a lot of nervous laughter.
I wondered how Hong Kong cinema goers in 1974 reacted to that.
Yeah.
Whether it would have actually made people turn around and question what was happening, or if they just would have laughed it off. But I thought it was kind of a neat little twist.
Yeah, I loved that. But yeah, one of my favorite scenes was when she starts just bashing the Taoist monk with like a rock, and it's not phasing him at all, because he gets right up and then Pao Lin kills him. But I love it. Like, okay, well, he's just going to get his ass fucking handed to him. Like he doesn't do anything.
Yeah.
Then the change of another change of event was when, Ann Peen dies, her boyfriend. And then, what is her name? Ewan Ma, like her coworker, brings her to her great auntie's house. And I'm like, okay, where the fuck are we going?
Yeah, we're here. We're going from here. We're going to here. We're going here. And I do. And this kind of leads to, we finally get to like the final fight where she finally figures out that she needs smoke. So she buys all the incense and uses that. And that's kind of one of my favorite ones. One of my favorite moments is like that final, I'll call it a fire fight or smoke fight. That disintegration, the smoking skull. I do like the priest getting beat up as well. That's all that's always fun. Yeah. Well, not Taoist priests, they're nice, but
Yeah, that fire, that's classic Hammer horror ending. Yeah. The melting, literally melting into a skeleton, huge fire in the background. Love it.
And then we have we're at the end, a downbeat ending, which I always love.
Love it to death. Yeah. So spoiler alert, Balin does not survive. She becomes possessed by this vampire demon, which I fucking love, love, love.
Yeah. It rhymes. It's like poetry. He died in the fire and was possessed by the ghost. Now she has died in the fire. And now she is possessed by
it. There's a great cut towards the end of the movie where she's screaming and then it jump cuts right to the ambulance siren.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That I thought was really cool. One thing I want to mention though, before it escapes my fleeting memory. So when Ah-Peen dies, right, he falls off the ship.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Was that a watermelon?
It looked like it. Looked yeah.
Like Didn't it? Yeah. Like yeah. to me, that was like painfully obvious.
Yeah, it was a melon for sure. Because yeah, I thought like, okay, there's something floating in the water with him.
Like, yeah, and then it just gets squished. And I was like, okay, not the Shaw Brothers special effects aren't always 100% convincing, but like this was bad.
Maybe that's why it doesn't have a Blu-ray, because they're like, ooh, that special effect's bad. We don't want people to see that. Yeah, maybe.
They got to give it the special edition treatment. Yep. Han Solo step on Jabba's tail there.
Also want to give a shout out to the random kitten that just shows up and goes meow and is never heard from again. Yeah. And the hermit with the bad teeth who shows up and is never heard from again.
Yeah.
And the guy who's in the second salon when she's working. And I think he's whistling the same tune.
Oh,
she's
like reading love letters.
Yeah. Yeah. And he's like, what are you doing? Reading my love letters? And then he kind of disappears, never to be heard from again as well. There's some lot of randomness.
I feel like that's almost the most, and maybe the only kind of humorous scene is that guy. Mm-hmm. Another one that kind of stands out too is the old lady that's telling Palin about the fire that killed the optometrist. Mm-hmm. She's like so into it. And she's like, oh, his eyes were burnt out and his hair was gone. And he popped up and ran to the house and died. Mm-hmm. And these other guys come around her and start like chiming in. Like that one was pretty humorous too. But that character was really, there's so many just little side characters that stand out.
Well, there's so many men just lurking in the grass ready to pop out at her.
Well, I don't know if most of those are dead. Like, is she seeing dead people?
I don't know.
Yeah, there's a lot to love in this. Like that foggy overgrown cemetery. I love that.
Look and at the that. Guy pops out there too.
Yeah.
That's what
he tries to rape her. Doesn't get away with it, thankfully, but he tries.
Yeah.
I love how she opens locked doors. You know, the nails pop out of the boards.
That was a cool touch.
It's kind of creepy. And one of my favorite scenes too is him just casually dropping as he's getting a manicure the second time that he's immortal. He's like, "Shut up! Don't tell anybody. You're dead in 3 days." You know, just like keep fixing my cuticles.
Yeah.
I like the scene where Balin is actually giving a ghost a manicure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was neat. That was a neat touch. She's just kind of there putting a manicure on. Well, we can't see anything. She's supposed to be able to see it, but we're seeing it from the same point of view as the other people in the salon. She's like, what the hell is wrong with her?
Yeah.
But
yeah.
It's like you said earlier, no one really, I mean, somebody goes up to her and is like, what are you doing? And she's like, I'm giving a manicure. But nobody at that point is like, you need help. They're just like, oh, okay.
Yeah. There's a lot of like, you know, yeah, just kind of ignoring and her not asking, and I like that. I do appreciate that, but I could see it, you know, bothering people. Like, okay, she's gonna relive this whole, you know, traumatic events over and over again until she figures it out.
Yeah.
Yep.
And like you said, Erica, I do like how they throw it out in different areas of the movie, mainly probably within the last 20 minutes, where she just remembers him with, you know, Ah-Peen talking about the incense or. Right. When the guy with the cigarette in the salon.
Yeah.
It works.
Yeah. I like it.
I love it.
Well,
me too.
I like it.
Anything else you wanted to bring up about it, Ian, Erica?
I got all my notes.
I did think it was interesting that it portrays Hong Kong as a complete shithole. It's not glitzy or glamorous really at all. Like even the back room of the salon, which you would think would be like nice and clean and tidy, is kind of a hellhole full of rats.
Yeah.
And then
everybody's place seems real run down.
Her apartment is literally falling apart. The first time when he comes to visit her at night, every step he takes is creaky and loud because it's old and decrepit. That was kind of atypical for a Shaw Brothers movie to do that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Leaning hard into the horror movie aspect of like everything being sort of like scary, rotting. Yeah, exactly.
Cool. Well, let's pick a double feature for Ghost Eyes. Yeah. You guys ready?
Let's.
Ian, let's start with you.
Carnival of Souls.
Oh.
Ah, there it is.
Very good.
Nice.
As we were watching it, my wife kind of like poked me and said, this has a Carnival of Souls vibe. Do you think she died at the car accident at the beginning? And I was immediately convinced that, yes, that's exactly where it was going. And we had this all figured out. It didn't quite work out that way. But I feel like it does feel like Carnival Souls a lot. Especially in the first half, less so in the second half, but in the first half,
for sure,
it's really similar. Obviously, black and white versus color, there's cultural differences and stuff, but even the performance of the two lead actresses, I think, is fairly close in how they bring their characters to life and how they kind of portray their crumbling sanity based on these strange predicaments that they've put in. So I think Carnival of Souls and Ghost Eyes would be an excellent double feature.
I like it.
I do too. What about you, Erica?
I actually have one very similar to Ian's.
Oh, okay.
But before I get to that, let me go through my train of thought here.
Okay.
So I think obviously, like, there's a handful of Dracula adaptations you could go with. John mentioned The Night Stalker, the Kolchak movie.
Darren McGavin?
Yeah. And I was like, I don't see it. Like, it's a vampire movie, but he had said something else about it. And I was like, I don't see it. So anyway, I'm just putting that out there. Cause you know what? John's not always right.
So. I mean, I like it cause it's so fucking weird and random.
Okay. Like, John's wrong. So I think there's plenty of like Hong Kong vampire movies. You know, there's a Mr. Vampire series. I wouldn't go there cause like the comedy aspect to me wouldn't really work. Because this one has more of like a blend of an East and West element for the vampire. It's got traits kind of from each. I think something like Vampire's Breakfast from 1987 could work. The vampire ghosts look like they have like Dawn of the Dead zombie makeup in that one. It's fun. This one might balance that out a little bit just because it's got the same kind of vampire, like a little bit of East and West mixed in. But obviously that's not my... ultimate. Oh, it does have a Kent Cheng is in it as Fatty. So there's another sweet. Fatty. But let me get to my actual pick. And like Ian, I am going with a 60s black and white film, William Castle's 13 Ghosts.
Okay.
And I'm doing that because, okay, so first of all, I think everyone knows the film, a family inherits a home with ghosts. They have to stay there, et cetera, et cetera. But why I think this would make a fun double feature is because of Castle's gimmick. For the audience watching this film, Illusiono, which allowed the audience to choose whether or not they would see the ghosts based on the red or the blue lenses. So, you know, and there are releases which are edited to replicate that effect. So if you watch it at home, you kind of get it. It's not the same as watching it in the theater and like, you know, William Castle giving you your right. glasses. But
your ghost eyes, if you will.
Yeah, exactly. Your ghost eyes. So I would go William Castle's 13 Ghosts, not the fucking remake.
Oh,
anybody.
No, stay away from that.
God.
I have not seen the remake. Okay, so my turn.
Yes.
I got Hellraiser vibes for a minute when Mr. She turns into almost this Uncle Frank role, asking Palin to bring him victims.
Yeah.
So it felt like this Julia and Frank relationship for a bit to me. We've picked Hellraiser. I think you picked it for a double feature.
I've picked it for a double feature before, and Abraham has actually picked the second one.
That's right. Hellbound. Yeah.
So yeah, Hellraiser has been done. It's off the table.
Off the table. Okay. So I focused more on we've already talked about it, like the otherworldly feel of Ghost Eyes, how it turns kind of into these regular kind of boring characters trying to figure out the supernatural elements of this mysterious man that pops onto the scene. And this made me think of Phantasm. Also, smoke bothers Mr. She, and like the tall man, he has an aversion to the cold. Mm-hmm. I was reminded of that scene, you know, in Phantasm when the tall man walks by Reggie's ice cream truck and he has that reaction to the cold coming off the truck. Not nearly as violent as a reaction Mr. She has with the smoke, but nonetheless, there's like these aversions to these ordinary mixtures or elements. So I'm going to go with Don Coscarelli's Phantasm. We have the immortal tall man and the immortal Mr. She, and he's causing the main characters and the viewers to wonder what the hell he's up to and what makes him so powerful. So also Phantasm's under 90 minutes, and I wanted something short to pair with Ghost Eyes. So mysterious tall men that have supernatural powers that you're trying to guess until the end, what the fuck's going on, double feature.
I like it.
I like it too. And Erica, your pick kind of ties into that comment the priest makes about the people behind you in the theater too.
Oh, yes.
Right. Oh my God. Yeah. Even better.
Yeah. That quote should be like on t-shirts from that. I love that Taoist monk quote. Mm-hmm. Like, it's so good.
Yeah.
Right. Ian, thanks again for joining us. It's always a blast.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. Can you remind folks where they can find you, follow you, your podcast, RSP?
Yeah. RockShockPop.com is the website with all the reviews and the really old school forum. So if, like some of us, you're tired of social media and you just want to talk about movies somewhere else, you can do that there. It's 99% asshole free. on socials, you can follow me at RockShockPop on Twitter. If you look for RockShockPop on Facebook, you'll find it there. I'm on Instagram at IanJane75, but that's mostly comic book stuff. And if you want more comic book stuff, you can go to queenscomicparty.com, download episodes of the podcast, or you can search for Queens Comic Podcast on Spotify or whatever other platform you get your podcasts on.
Nice. And on your Instagram, will you be sharing any future commentaries that you're doing, like beforehand? Not beforehand, but when announcements are made, do you share that stuff on your Instagram?
I should.
You should. That's what I'm saying. People follow you and wait for those to be posted.
I should. Yeah, I should. I've posted on my personal Facebook page, but obviously people who don't know me aren't on there and don't see it. I kind of suck at self-promotion.
Yeah, well.
Yeah, I do too. I get it.
We all do. I mean, we could all.
When the Shout Collection 2 is coming out?
Any day now. I think it's already shipping from the website.
Oh, sick.
So okay. I don't know that it's at other retailers yet, but okay. Shout usually ships their stuff early if you order it direct from them.
Okay.
So it's on there. It's a big set. It's, I think, 13 discs, 13 wow. movies, something like that. So yeah, it's pretty huge.
Wow. I've got the first one, but I didn't buy because I saw that and I was like, I don't have money for that right now. But
yeah, they're not cheap.
Well, I'll suck it up now because you've got commentaries mm-hmm. on there. So yeah, God support
thank
that.
You, thank you.
Yeah, I can't wait to hear what you have coming next, too.
Yeah. We want to hear about the other three.
I can't.
I know, not now, but when you can, I want to know.
When I can, I will message you guys.
All right. Excellent. So everyone, please follow Ian. He does great work. I can attest to Rock Chalk Pock being 99% asshole free. I don't chat there much, but I do lurk and everyone there is very nice. So it's a great place to communicate with folks. If you're a comic book fan, check out his podcast. Pick up the new Shout Factory collection of Shaw Brothers films. Check out his commentaries. Check out his other work. Just do all the things because Ian's great and we love him. And listen to the other episodes that he's been on here with us. Yeah. And he'll be back next year for Shawgist again.
Hell yes. I hope.
We can make the timing work. I'll absolutely do it. And if you want to have me back for a non-Shawgist spider type film or whatever, you know how to get a hold of me.
Of course.
Yes.
All right. Thanks, Ian. We will talk to you soon.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Bye. Thank you.
Bye.
You know how to whistle, don't you, Steve? You just put your lips together and blow.
Erica, we have wrapped up another season of Shawgist.
Oh, happy Shawgist, everyone.
Yeah, good work. Two good picks. Just good stuff.
We'll see what'll happen next year, because last year we were worried that there wouldn't be anything available this year. And I mean, I already broke the rules, so fuck it. You know, we'll figure it out.
We will figure it out. There are some that are out there, but just harder to find, I think. Okay, so Shawgist is over. We are going into September.
Yes. We're getting close to October, which means that very soon we'll be sharing our list of Horror Gives Back categories.
Hell
so,
yes.
And I'm just going to say it right now. You know what, Discord folks, you're going to get first peek at those.
I like that idea. I think that's smart. They could start putting their lists together.
Yeah. And everyone who's not in there yet, maybe that'll give you a reason to finally join. We miss you. We don't know who you are, but we miss you.
I know exactly who you are. So please jump in Discord.
But before that, we have September and we have some movies to cover in September. So my next pick, we're going to the other side of the world. We are going to be going to France.
Oh.
And we are going to be covering Night of Death! From 1980, or La Nuit de la Mort, directed by Raphael Delpard. This film is about a woman named Martine. She gets a new job at a convalescent hospital in the French countryside, where recent and former employees seem to go missing quite often, even the woman who has trained her. So she soon discovers something sinister going on, but who would suspect the geriatric residents to have anything to do with it?
I mean, I probably would.
I would too. Old people, you can't fucking trust them.
Yeah, so scary.
So yeah, Night of Death, 1980. Night of Death with an exclamation point, which we will find out if it deserves the exclamation point with our guest.
Oh,
we're going to have another guest. We're on a roll here. This is someone I have wanted to have on the show for a really long time. I'm a huge fan of everything that he does. And that is Bill Ackerman. He is the host of the Supporting Characters podcast, which is one of my favorite podcasts and is extremely re-listenable. I don't know if that's a word, but I do re-listen.
It works.
He's also had another podcast called From the Neighborhood, which is a series of conversations with people involved in the making of David Lynch's 1986 film, Blue Velvet. So, Lance, maybe you guys can geek out about Twin Peaks.
Yeah, we are going to be covering Blue Velvet on the next episode.
He also frequently co-hosts the Directors Club podcast. And I can't even begin to list off all of the contributions that he has made to physical media releases. But just to name a few of my favorites, he provided the commentary track for Fun City Edition's release of Natural Enemies, starring Hal Holbrook and Louise Fletcher. He has a booklet essay in the upcoming release of Messiah of Evil from Radiance. I haven't even read it yet. It's already a favorite. I love this movie and I love Bill.
Yeah.
He has a commentary with our previous guest, Amanda Reyes, on the Second Sight release of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre that they recorded at the Texas Chainsaw Massacre house, the one that's a restaurant now. John and I went there a couple years ago. It's okay.
Terrible barbecue, right? Oh.
Okay. Oh, no. That's the gas station down in Bastrop.
Right.
The barbecue there is not good. The food at the restaurant, when we went a couple years ago, was fine. It was, you know, you're not there for the food. I'm there because it's the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Yeah. Anyway. So I could go on forever, but I do not do nearly as much research as Bill does for his episodes. If you listen to him on Supporting Characters, you know what I'm talking about. Suffice to say, a lot of the work Bill does is academically conversational. He is extremely knowledgeable. And so this will be a great episode and conversation. So Bill Ackerman, next episode, Night of Death. This is on a very weird website called fdupmovies.com. I did check. It's not a weird, like, it's not like
Russian porn.
It's not Russian porn or anything like that. I'll put a link to that in show notes. I'll also put a link in our Discord for next episode. I did check it. It's got subtitles and everything. It works. I don't know why it's not on. Someone didn't just put it on YouTube, but Night of Death next episode. Before we get into our plugs, we have another former guest, Josh Hurtado, who will be in Austin in September and hosting a Weird Wednesday presentation of an Indian film.
Yeah, I got my tickets.
You did? Yeah. Okay, sweet.
It's right before Fantastic Fest.
Right before Fantastic Fest, which I am not going to this year.
I'm not either.
Okay.
Unless somebody gives me a badge or something.
I definitely entered a few contests
I did
for
too.
A badge.
I mean, I'm going to comment on every Instagram giveaway, but I don't want to go.
I just want to go to like 5 movies. I don't want to pay for that much.
No, yeah, I'm excited to see Josh again and see this this introduction.
It's going to be super fun. Yeah. So if you are in Austin, it's selling out quickly if it's not sold out already. So definitely get a ticket. If it is already sold out and you're in Austin, just keep an eye on it because usually someone will dump tickets like the day of if they can't make it.
Yeah.
So just keep an eye out for
that. September 20th, Wednesday.
Yes, Wednesday, September 20th at Alamo South Lamar. If you are not already, you can follow our podcast on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook, all at Unsung Horrors. And you can follow me on Letterboxd, Instagram, and Twitter at Hex Massacre.
You can follow me on Letterboxd, Instagram at El Shivey.
Happy Shoggist once again, folks. And we'll see you back next month. Bye.
Bye. Thanks for listening. My eyes are seeing you. 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 Turn this down. Fix your hair. Move upstairs. Move upstairs. Oh,
Hey, it's Death by Video.
I'm Phil.
I'm Kit.
And I'm Graham, saying welcome to our podcast full of merry movie mayhem.
Ever wonder what an Irish kung fu movie would look like?
It's called Fatal Deviation, and we covered it.
Ever wonder what a movie about 1,000 cats would look like?
It's called Night of 1,000 Cats, and we covered it.
And it stars Hugo Stiglitz. Listen to Death by Video to hear us discuss and dissect some of the weirdest, wildest, and wackiest films ever made. All this and more on Death by Video! Woo!